Groupthink is often generated just by this lack of diversity of identity. If you put people who look different, and it doesn't mean just men and women, it can be, like I said before, skin color, age, even, you know, neurodivergence, sexual orientation, all these people that look different, then we have psychological safety of being different. We don't feel like, oh, how do I fit in? Well, I fit in because everyone's different, so it doesn't really matter what I look like because we're all different.
Welcome to Building Doors. In this series, you'll develop the skills to build a roadmap for success, get inspired by those leaders who have come before you, and give you the confidence to stop waiting and start building.
Dominique Gill established her own business in 2016. UrbanCore is the first female-led construction company of its kind, and is already defining a new generation in Australian construction. With annual revenues exceeding $60 million, UrbanCore have successfully delivered hundreds of projects and won their first Master Builders Association of New South Wales Awards for Excellence in Construction in 2021 and then another two in 2023. Dom is also both the National and New South Wales NAHWIC 2021 Crystal Vision Award winner. She's a pioneer in diversity and inclusion, a vocal champion for women in constructive, and actively promotes the promotion of the industry to a younger generation. In 2022, she launched an exciting program, a fully now established not-for-profit NextGen, to address female representation in construction. It's a multi-state program where female leaders in construction present to girls' schools and talk about rewards of working in the industry. UrbanCore, interestingly, is now counting more than 50 full-time staff, 50% female, and is present in three states. Dominique intends to continue growing her business to become one of the key players in the construction industry and to challenge the all-too-common perception that construction is a man's world. On top of managing a very demanding career, Dominique is also the mother of three beautiful school-aged daughters. She is a wonderful testimony that motherhood and career are indeed compatible. Welcome to the Building Doors podcast, Dom. Thank you so much for coming on as a guest. I know we've been playing backwards and forwards phone tag with schedules to try and make this happen. So I really appreciate you taking the time, because I keep seeing your posts and hikes and some of the initiatives you've had for International Women's Day as well. So there's so much that I'm keen to discuss with you. So let's get stuck into it. First question, why construction? Why was that the industry you chose?
Yeah, look, that's always a really interesting question, because I didn't really choose it. Like most people, I think construction chose me.
Yeah.
I initially studied business. I really enjoyed business studies. I then studied urban planning. I loved anything to do with planning big towns and master planning and how a city works and all that. And then a friend of mine told me, you know, if you want to be an urban planner, you should probably be an architect first, because an architect can always become an urban planner, but not really the other way around. And so off I went studying architecture, wanting to be really more like into urban planning. And then actually graduated as an architect and worked as an architect for about 5 years, and kind of left the whole idea of urban planning a little bit behind, and really enjoyed my time working in this industry, because obviously already in this industry as an architect. But I felt like something was missing. As an architect, I worked a lot on projects that didn't really happen. You know, you start documenting a job and then the DA doesn't get approved, or the client sells the site, or they run out of money, or the project gets canned. And then I felt really frustrated by that, because I wanted to see things come off the ground. So then at that point, I thought, well, I'm better off working for a builder. So I joined a construction company, which was Built, and I did that. I worked there for about 10 years. First started making coffees and photocopies, because, you know, I was an architect, so obviously I knew nothing about construction, which was interesting, because there was a little bit of truth to that, to a degree. You know, I walked in there really confidently going, I know construction, I'm an architect, but obviously there was a lot I still had to learn. And then absolutely found my passion, you know, from the second sort of week on the job. I was put on the QVB refurbishment. Do you know the QVB in Sydney?
Yeah.
And we were working on, you know, installing the escalators to try and activate the level one and two. And sort of second week on the job, I saw these gigantic escalators hovering in this heritage atrium, and we'd had a crane downstairs, a crane upstairs, and we closed Market Street and Jaw Street, and I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. I just thought it was the most magical thing, like just to see these escalators, you know, flying in the air with people shouting everywhere and safety, and, you know, it was so interesting, and I thought, this is so cool. Like, this is exactly where I want to be. And then after that, there was just no going back. I always wanted to get that feeling of like, we are creating something and what we do is so tangible, and how rewarding it was, that job. So that's how I started in construction.
I've thought about this for a little bit around International Women's Day and a lot of the stuff that everyone's been talking about around attracting a more diverse talent pool and things like that in the industry. Do we sell construction well enough? Like, as an industry, what are your thoughts around the messaging we send?
Yeah, look, it's a horrific message. I think the construction industry does really, really poorly at marketing itself. There are industries that are also, I mean, most industries are challenging. I mean, life is challenging in any case. But, you know, you look at, like, for example, the defense force, the police force. I think they have some really positive messaging around what they do. They manage to really attract people to their industry. If you look at construction in the media, it's all some kind of public project that miserably failed, that was 10 times over budget. This is how we spend the taxpayers' money, and the light rail's not finished 3 years later and all of that. And I think people, they don't want to be associated with that. You know, it's not a good look. It's not attractive for anyone to work in this industry where everything seems to go wrong and money's going down the drain. And also, I think it's an industry that's a little bit low tech, you know, if I can say that. And the new skill set, like the new people that come to construction, they have these new skills and they're really tech savvy, and they're like, why would I go in construction where everything seems to be so backwards? And so I think there's a real, real image problem. And obviously we'll start talking about women in construction as well, because that image is bad for everyone, but it's particularly bad for women. And I think there's a lot of work to be done with that, because to me, it's so much fun and it's so exciting and it's so rewarding and it pays well and there's so many opportunities for everyone. So I feel like we need to work on that. I always sing the praises of construction. One of the paradoxes I find with construction is people talk about how it's not inclusive and it's homophobic and it's bad for women. But we need to also think about the fact that anyone can join construction. There's actually no barriers for entry in this industry at all. You can be, basically, if you breathe, you can get a job in construction. You can be a homeless person, knock on the door of a construction site, and they're likely to give you a laboring job for a day. You know, we need those people. You can be coming out of prison and finding a job in construction. So I actually find that really quite beautiful about this industry, you know, because it is inclusive, because anyone really can join us. But the problem is, because it's so inclusive and it's so open to anyone, we have also a pretty rough side to things, you know, where people are sort of can come from, you know, low education levels or criminal background. And so it gives that sort of really image that it's rough and challenging and difficult and dirty and ugly, and therefore people don't want to go there, if that makes sense. So for me, it's hard to really sell construction. Oh, because we take everyone, it's good, you know, but it is actually quite nice. But obviously we need to start singing the praises of what the industry has to offer, which is fantastic teamwork. Like I said, money to be made, a really good camaraderie. You know, there's so many things about construction that is beautiful.
I did want to chat to you more around one of the things you spoke about then, which was really interesting, is what does construction look like to women, right?
Yeah.
And I know of many women I work with at John Holland that have left the industry. So that's been more the barriers with having a partner that works in the industry and works long hours and trying to juggle. That's the reality of some of them. But deeper than that as well, we see enough coming through. And if we're not, where's the messaging wrong to women, do you think?
Yeah, look, I think the issue is probably starts at quite a young age, you know, and it probably starts with parents and teachers. And it is quite common for a mother to, you know, give the digger to her son and give the Barbie doll to her daughter. And these are just really cliches, but it's true. You know, it's generally what happens. So there is this kind of, we try to encourage the boys towards these jobs and these women towards these other things. And in fact, it's really interesting stats around kids who don't finish school, kids who finish after year 10. The boys are actually, they found that amongst all the kids that don't go all the way to year 12, the boys do so much better than the girls. And that's because the boys are immediately encouraged to take on a trade and, you know, become a carpenter, an electrician. And the girls are encouraged to do beauty and nails and hairdressing. And you just don't get up to the salaries that the trades get to in beauty and hair, if that makes sense. So suddenly all these girls are really penalized because they're being told, well, you know, you're a girl, so you should probably do those things, and the boys, you should probably do those things. And as a result, there's a real imbalance there. So for me, the messaging needs to start really early on, which is, you know, why I launched, in addition to my construction company, I launched this not-for-profit called NextGen, which stands for Next Generation Construction, where we go and reach out to girls in schools and try and say to them, this is what's possible in construction. the first question I ask is, you know, and I show up in a suit and a jacket is, you know, I say, if you ran into me on the street, would you think that I work in construction? And they say, no, no, you'd be in marketing or you'd be in luxury goods or something or makeup. And it's like, well, not at all. I work in construction and these jobs actually exist. So there is also this image that construction equals a trade, which is true to a degree, but construction is a lot more than that. There are just so many different professions and we don't talk about them. And we sort of make the stigma even worse by having kids in school who say, boys or girls that are generally the boys that are mucking around at the back of the class being told by the teacher that stop swearing and being rude or you belong on a construction site, you know, this is where you'll end up type thing, as if that's the behavior that we see on the construction sites. Therefore, if you have that behavior, that's where you should be. And, you know, we sort of have that sort of vicious circle where we're not able to change that mindset. So for me, you know, it's really important that we go and speak to girls, that we open their minds about what's there. I'm always very, very surprised at the way the kids react in school when you ask, have any of you thought about a career in construction? And no one puts their hand up, or maybe one person because they feel really sorry for me. And then I'll do a whole presentation about, oh, this is what these guys do. This is my, and generally I'll bring my project manager and she'll be talking about what she's doing every day. And then I'll talk about the different skills that you can acquire that you don't even need to stay in construction. You can take those skills with you elsewhere later and they'll still be useful. Negotiation and communication and teamwork and all of those things that you need in most industries anyway. And then at the end of the presentation, I ask the question again, you know, would any of you consider a job in construction? And suddenly all these girls are like, yeah, sounds really good. Sounds really fun, you know. So it's actually not that hard. But the real barrier is actually getting in front of those girls. And a lot of the time what I find is even career advisors in schools, they sort of say, oh, I love your next-gen program, love what you do. But that's not for us. That's not what our school wants to promote. You know, like, do you know a surgeon or do you know an investment banker? And I was like, that's exactly what I'm trying to change here. So to me, there's a lot of educating to be done with the parents and with the career advisors and even with the school principals, just trying to get in there and say, guys, that needs to become an industry of choice. You know, that's my mission. Let's make construction a first choice. How do we create a degree at uni in construction management that needs a 95 plus ATAR? You know, suddenly everyone would be like, oh, it's so hard to get in. That's what I want to do. I got 95 plus, I can do construction. But no, at the moment it's, well, I couldn't get into law. I couldn't get into medicine. So I couldn't get into this. So I ended up in construction, you know, which is a real problem, you know, and that's probably why the industry is so challenged and has huge financial issues and has huge, you know, regulatory issues. It's got so many challenges because we need to kind of raise that level of sophistication of the industry as a whole, which is what I'm trying to do.
I love it. I think one of the things you spoke about there that really hit the nail for me as well was around the diversity of careers in construction. So I was speaking to someone the other day and they're like, I don't really want to be an engineer. I was like, it's not just engineering.
Yeah.
In construction, you know, we know that there's commercial, contracts, admin, there's legal counsel roles where they're sitting in. It is such a diverse industry in terms of the different career pathways available that may not be a trade, that may not be an engineer. And you came from that architecture background and then came through as well.
Yep.
So I think going to the schools is a great initiative to expose, get them to explore in their minds what else could be possible. What else could be possible? What does a career in construction look like? Because I do agree with you. I think a lot of the media that's around construction is the gender pay gap. Construction's losing money on this job. Look at all these businesses going broke. Like if I'm a person coming in and choosing a career right now, what am I seeing on the news?
Yeah, yeah.
This company's broke. This company's gone broke.
Yeah.
And I love that you are changing the narrative on that because it is really important because people are watching and making those decisions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Another example I had of that is some of the schools, they invite us actually to their career showcase, which is more of a like after school event where, you know, different universities present what they do. And the kids come with the parents as well. So, and the parents might say, oh, why don't you look at a gap year in London or something like that? And then we're sitting there going, oh, construction, you know. And the parents will go, no, keep walking, you know, don't stop there. Like, let's go to the next one. And one of the signs that we had changed at the last one we went to, because we're really finding that, you know, some of the girls were like, oh, look at these guys, what are they doing? And the parents were like, no, keep walking. We changed the signage and we said, do you want to make some money and meet some boys? As opposed to, do you want to work in construction? And then suddenly all the girls were like, oh, mom, money, boys, let's go. And even the parents were like, yeah, what is that? And then we're like, oh, we're a construction company. And it was like, oh, all right, okay, didn't expect that. But it was just about changing the narrative a little bit because construction just has that reputation, you know, that it's ugly and dirty. It's something I want to change.
Do you know what else you hit there? But by doing that, I don't know if you feel this, but I feel it is the most down-to-earth, great sense of humour. We take our work seriously, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. You can have a lot of fun on a project.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, there is that sense of lightheartedness and camaraderie in a project too.
And look, to me, what's been really interesting as well is how much support I get from the men and the boys. Like, some boys want to go in construction, but they're annoyed that there's not going to be any girls there. They like what I'm doing. I speak to boys who think about a trade because they're being, that's a natural thing for them, but they kind of hate the idea that there's not going to be any girls there. So suddenly they hear about me trying to get more girls and they're like, yeah, you go, you need to get us some more girls in the in construction because we want that diversity. Everyone wants it. It's good for everyone. And it makes it a lot easier as well for a girl to want to join the industry if she feels like she's going to be welcome there. It's not a sort of a question of, oh, we want to take, we have one big pie and we need to share between the boys and the girls. It's like we're literally making that pie bigger and there's enough for everyone. And in fact, we keep talking about the shortage of labor in construction and yet, you know, we're ignoring half the population. So it's like, well, you're not sure how to solve the problem. You keep sticking people on aeroplanes and like trying to give, you know, bonuses to builders who hire people, workers from overseas. And I'm like, really? Is that the answer? Can't you just look right or left, you know, where the workers are? So what's one of the things we're trying to speak up about?
What I love about you is you don't just speak up about it, you do it. You know, you've got 50%, you know, like that is a big thing. It's not just cupcakes and bullshit with you, Dom. Yeah. You know, it's literally you're actually doing it. So one thing I wanted to ask you about as well, 50%.
Yeah.
So at Urban Core, you're sitting at, tell me, like, what are some of the things that you did to get to that? It's a journey. Like, it's not easy in the industry to get to that point.
No.
What did you do?
Well, look, I mean, it was part of the core mission. The reason I started Urban Core was because I was frustrated in my previous company because I was trying to say, bring on more women. And they were like, yeah, but it's freaking hard. So we're just going to keep going the way we're going because it's working, by the way. And I get it. You know, I wasn't in management or I wasn't in a position where I could make those kind of systemic changes. So I thought I'm going to start my own construction company. Firstly, it was me taken care of because I think there was also a big battle when I worked for a bigger firm where it was, how do I get ahead? Will I be the first female construction manager in my company? You know, where do I go? So as soon as I started my own business, that was kind of like, well, I guess I'm top of the tree, much, much, much smaller tree, but that's me taken care of. And I feel like that was already an important step. Then I wanted to hire women. So I started with doing what I could. And initially, I mean, there was a point where there was only four of us and it was two girls and two boys. And I was like, we've got it, 50%. We've done it, you know. And then I was like, yeah, that doesn't really make a dent in the industry. You know, I felt like it wasn't good enough at case study, so I never made a song and dance about that period. But then really quickly, obviously, as soon as you start winning construction projects, you know, you need site supervision. Really, really hard to get women in site supervision. So my stats were always good, but they were never that good. First, some of the strategies I used, I guess, is first, you know, in all modesty, my own open-mindedness about, you know, looking at resumes that don't tick exactly all the boxes, that horizontal entries from other industries, like always was quite encouraging. Another thing I did is I work quite closely with recruiters and I do pay them more for a female recruit versus a male recruit.
Oh.
So they kind of feel like, you know, positive discrimination, I guess, in that sense. And so they feel a bit more like they want to work a bit harder to try and help me find that one woman that meets that criteria. Mm. Because the reality is there's always a woman that's going to meet the criteria. You can always fill that job with a woman if you choose to. You've just got to work a little bit harder to go and find her.
Yeah.
That's the reality. So what's shifted really for me, I think, and that's where, because we had a target of 40%, and I thought 40% is still probably an Australian first, probably even, you know, global first. Like, I was happy with 40%, but the shift came when suddenly I became a really attractive company for women. And suddenly, instead of me paying recruiters lots of money to go and find that, women were coming to me. And that's kind of what happened in the last sort of three or four recruits. It was people saying, I want to work for Urban Core. I love that it's a diverse company. It was already diverse enough sort of to make it attractive. And then suddenly I was able to get heaps more interest. And then also I got really good male candidates for the reason that I stated before. You know, some guys, they actually don't really belong in the boys' club and they don't really like it and they're not particularly blokey and they feel like, it's great to have a diverse workforce, and it's not just gender, by the way. You know, it's age and it's background and it's skin color and it's sexual orientation. It's all of that. And so starting to get, you know, it's been quite nice in the last year because, you know, Lauren, how there is a shortage of labor. So a lot of interviews I've done in the last few years was me begging the candidate to choose me as opposed to them selling themselves. You get yourself into these complete reverse interviews. You barely know what they can or can't do. And you're just like, so what is it going to take for you to come and join me? And so, yes. You know, like the table started turning a little bit where they were like, I've already got three offers. I don't really want them. I really want to work for you. Tell me what I need to do to work for you. And so that's where I was able to really kind of get that last sort of 40 to 50% that jump. And, you know, it was only an extra three, four women to make it work. But that sort of happened like last November, December last year. So in January, we started showcasing the 50%, which we're very proud of.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I want to chat more about this because I was speaking to a female engineer, like I think a week or so ago at an event about this, and I wanted your thoughts on it. When we talk about things like positive discrimination and we talk about want to close that gap, but at the same time also getting the best person for the job at hand, how do we balance it in a way that we don't, that we're rising with men and with them sponsoring the change, male allies, all of that discussion? How do you walk that fine balance between them knowing that we're trying to get a more diverse workforce, but then also letting the women know you're not here just because you're a woman. You're here because you're freaking good at your job.
Yeah.
How do we balance that?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting question because I get asked almost exclusively about gender diversity.
Mm.
But in reality, my narrative to my staff and internally is just a diversity of identity because I'm not here to start creating this man-hating club or I don't want to look like that, you know, because that's the other issue in construction is then you have this women in construction movement, which is taking off, but is scary, you know, and the guys are like, oh, they're taking our jobs and they all want to. And some people have asked me before, it's like, oh, so is your goal 100% women? And I was like, no, that would not be diverse. I don't want to do that.
Not diversity.
But, yeah. Exactly. What I do is I educate people about the benefits of diversity, of identity. So it's basically what happens is say you're in a room in a meeting with 15 people. If the 15 people look the same, so say they're all white and they're all men and they're all roughly the same age.
Mm-hmm.
The first instinct as a group of people is if we all look slightly alike, we actually want to be even more alike because our natural instinct is to want to fit in. So we're like, oh, everyone's kind of looking similar. Am I similar enough? So one person will speak up, give their opinion, and immediately you want to rally to that opinion because you want to fit in. So you're like, I'm not going to disrupt the group here. They all seem the same. And so that's how you get groupthink. And groupthink is often generated just by this lack of diversity of identity. If you put people who look different, and it doesn't mean just men and women, it can be, like I said before, skin color, age, even, you know, neurodivergence, sexual orientation, all these people that look different, then we have psychological safety of being different. We don't feel like, oh, how do I fit in? Well, I fit in because everyone's different, so it doesn't really matter what I look like because we're all different. The first person will speak, voice their opinion about something, and the second person will actually feel like they should have a different opinion because they look different. And so they feel more comfortable. They like that's the instinct. And so suddenly you've got 15 people who all want to bring something different to the table. And that creates a lot of creativity, a lot of collaboration, and a lot of psychological safety. And suddenly everyone feels, and it's beautiful. You have all these ideas that are thrown at you. And you can still, you know, have the project manager or the chair of the meeting make the call that we're going to go left and not in all those different ways. But everyone feels like they've had a chance to say something. And that's not men versus women. It's everybody, just the way they look. So that's what I really try to do in the business, to say to people, you are all empowered to be creative. Tell me you can do your job better. Tell me when because, you know, I'm a bit mad, sometimes a bit crazy. I'll go, oh, let's go and do this. And everyone, you know, they feel quite comfortable to say, nah, you're being crazy again. Let's do this instead. Or how about we do that? And I like that, you know, I like being challenged because I've got some good ideas and I've got some pretty terrible ones. So, and that's true for anyone who chairs a meeting with passion and wants to do something different or be innovative. And I think that's what we've been able to achieve is some real social innovation that has led to other innovations in the business, and that makes it attractive to everyone. So at the moment, I mentioned women knock on my door to work for Urban Core, but so do men, you know, so do men. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I love that. There's no bad idea in a thought shower. I say this to my team all the time because I always have lots of different ideas and I'm the same. Some of them are a bit like, okay, we can handle a few good ideas at a time.
Yeah.
Can resonate with that whole zany kind of, I've got so many ideas. Man. You do need people to call you and kind of say, great idea.
Yeah.
We're kind of committed to a lot of stuff right now, so let's park it.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a good idea. Not right now.
Yeah, I get a lot of, here we go. Every time I say, so I had an idea. What now? But anyway.
So one of the things I want to talk about a little bit as well, and this is something that it does apply to men and women, right, mm-hmm. with caregiving responsibilities and when you have a family. Mm-hmm. And I guess I talk about this honestly because it was the big change for me. Having worked 10 years in construction and then having kids, like I really struggled with the travel requirements and things like that with my husband being in a job that traveled too, right? So it was just like kind of a decision process. How do you work in and around, and what are you finding now around flexibility, family life? How does construction, or how can you adapt the industry to that? And that's for all people with families, really.
Well, look, I think there's definitely a room for flexible arrangements. I have a number of people here that are on flexible arrangements. I think one thing we don't realize, and that's also something, you know, I get proud that I've got an opportunity to say it on a podcast like this, is productivity. When someone's working for you 100% full time, they probably only give you their focus and their productivity for about 80 or 85% of the time. There's always a 15% kind of loss factor. When you hire someone for 3 days a week and they're working 60% of the time for 60% of the salary, you're very likely to get almost 100% of their focus during that time. Because, you know, they know that they're not there tomorrow and they have to leave at five or whatever it is. And therefore, to me, I want to tell employers, don't welcome flexibility arrangements because you're trying to tick a box or say that you can. Do it because it's a massive productivity dividend. It pays off. Like, the people who work part-time are actually more productive than the people who work full-time. So you're shutting the door to productivity. I think that's a really important point to make because, you know, I discussed before the labor shortage and how I feel like we should hire more women and some people feel like we should get immigrants to come and work. But I also say, let's just do more with less. How about we try and raise the level of productivity of this industry so that we're not there scrambling, trying to find workers from overseas? Why don't we just try and be more productive as we are? You know, one of the ways to be more productive is actually to introduce flexible arrangements. So do it. Pretty simple. But look, that's simple and it's beautiful on paper. One thing that I do struggle with, and I say that quite openly, and it may not be the most popular opinion, is people who confuse working from home and doing another job while they're at home, such as looking after kids. So for me, you know, I've got three kids. I know what it takes to look after kids. It's a job. Mm. If you're working full-time elsewhere, you generally have employed someone to look after your kids because that's a job. And some of the confusion that I find with people in flexible arrangements and working from home is I've had women actually come to Urban Core and say, I want to work here because I hear, you know, you're encouraging women and you're so behind us and I just need to work from home 2 days a week so I can look after my baby at the same time. And I'm just quite clear here that I'm hearing that you want to work 3 days a week because if you're at home looking after your baby, you're not working for me, you're doing a different job. And sometimes that's poorly received, but that's the reality. Looking after kids is a job. Looking for a construction company is another job. If you're doing both, then you're only doing both of them half productively. So that's one of the things that I try to be. So I'm obviously encouraging flexible arrangements, but I'm also, I can't possibly pay someone full time when they're looking after three kids under five, the same salary that someone who's also working from home, but just actually putting the full 8-10 hour days or whatever it is. So that's one of the things that I'm quite strict about because construction is bloody tough. We work on paper-thin margins. It's a war out there, you know. It's a race to the bottom and basically we can't afford to pay people full salaries if they're only working, you know, 40 or 50% of their day. So,
yeah, it's all the balance around you talking about being, because I think the thing is, honestly, you need to set boundaries with employees too. Yeah. It's like, yeah, happy to do working from home and flexibility. But when you are at home, your focus is still on this job. Mm. And if there is flexibility then, and you're doing a pickup or you're doing something like that, but the work still has to get done.
Correct.
We still have commitments to clients and you're operating on tight margins. So you can't afford for anything to slip.
Yep.
So the other question I wanted to ask you, why are construction companies going broke? Let's explore this. I want to know what's going on from a business owner point of view.
But how long have you got, Lauren, really?
Give me the one page.
I can talk about this for a really long time. But
I knew you'd want to, so we have to cover it. Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I feel is really broken about the system is that, you know, some people say, oh, there's four big banks in Australia, you know, and there's NAB and it's ANZ and CBA and whoever else. And I say there's five. You know, the fifth bank is the bloody builders. Because when you start a job, the first thing you do is you put up 5% of the contract value in bank guarantees. So that's just, say, your $20 million contract, $1 million. You've not even started the job. Generally, it's like 8 weeks even before the job starts. First thing you do is you hand over $1 million to someone. Secondly, contracts are obviously, the contract terms are such that you can't get a deposit paid, but the market is such that you can't order anything unless you pay a deposit. So $20 million job, first you give $1 million. Second, you pay $2 million in deposits, which you can't get back until the stuff actually gets to site, which sometimes can be 3 months later. So there's no cash, right? So we have no cash. Third, your margin is close to nothing because it's a race to the bottom and you've got to be the cheapest and you can only win if you're the cheapest. And because of what I was saying before, where there's a bit of a lack of sophistication and a lack of education, and some builders out there are undercutting because, I don't know, they have all these staff, they have this massive payroll, and they go, oh, we'll make it work, we'll make it work, we'll make it work. So they drop their price to a level that's actually not really viable, and they win the job on that, and then they start pressuring all the trades to drop their price and pressuring everyone. So there's this kind of snowball effect, which sometimes it just catches up with you. So the worst thing a builder can do is, when they're losing money, undercut on the next job to try and win that work or buy that work, because that's when they're going to be in trouble. So to me, I mean, one of the things I found really interesting when I tried to get my builder's license here in Sydney is because I had 10 years experience with built and done massive jobs, and I'm really good with contracts and budgets and profit and programs, and I understand everything about running a construction project, but I haven't got a trade. I'm just an architect. And I couldn't get my builder's license, you know. It was being refused to me. It was refused twice. And the Fair Trading said, oh, well, maybe you just need to go and do a trade. Like, and, you know, you can do a course in, like, waterproofing or something. And I was like, hold on a second. So I understand risk. I understand contracts. I understand programs. I understand money. But I need to labor on a site for 2 years before I can get a builder's license. So that was an issue. Anyway, I appealed and I got my license. But what this tells me is there's people that don't understand risk, don't understand contract, program, profit, but have been laboring on a side for 2 years and have got a builder's license. And they're the ones that sometimes I bid against. And they're putting in a price that goes, oh, well, tell me what the price needs to be and I'll do the job, you know? And there's the reason why we're all at this race to the bottom. And then suddenly they win the job and then they're like, oh, well, fuck, $1 million. I'm sorry, I'm swearing. Oops.
It's fine. It's a construction podcast. Keep going. Oops.
And they go, oh, what? I need to put $1 million in bank guarantees and what? $2 million in deposits? And oh, I don't have that. And boom, game over. So to me, you know, there's a real responsibility. And I'm actually really excited about this unfair contract terms legislation that's coming up, because contract terms is probably the biggest issue that this industry has, where a client believes that they're getting good value when they've got lowest price and maximum risk transfer. So they've got the guy who's priced, who's already the cheapest, but he's also accepted all of those risks. And to me, I mean, if that's not a red flag, you know, what is? We need to demonstrate to clients that's actually low value. You're confusing price and value. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've got a low price, but because all these risks have been put on the builder, you're getting actually low value out of that, because when there's a problem, that builder's going to fold. Because many, many builders have low balance sheet or cash for the reasons I explained. In any case, if one thing goes wrong on the job and they don't have a contingency, or the client is particularly difficult and chooses, they put in a $3 million claim and the client assesses it at like 1.5, sometimes that's enough. Just that.
Yeah.
That's like, well, where am I going to find that 1.5 million? Can't do it. See you later. So to me, there's a really big education piece to be done with the principals, the people that give us those contracts. And I'll be honest with you, I've seen head contracts come my way during tenders and they are absolutely horrendous. And I'm tempted to ring all the tenderers and say, can we all agree that nobody is signing that contract? That's it. We need to stick together here. But of course, too scared to do it, so I don't do it. But that's how it should be. We should all say no. And then I've had other experiences where I'm the cheapest or I'm neck and neck with someone, but they really like me and they love my mission and they love everything I do. But actually, someone's prepared to sign the contracts with no amendments. So you're right to do that, you know? And I feel like, what's the expectation there that I'm going to go, oh, right, okay, I'll take all the risk and here it is and I'll sign it, you know? That's just wrong. Like, I feel like saying, can't you see the red flag that they're signing that contract, which is going to send them bankrupt at the first issue? Like, that's something you should commend me for not wanting to sign. That should make you feel better, you know?
And then we see the flow-on effect as well, because the thing is, at the end of the day, sometimes you might have to pay a little bit more for a quality staff member because guess what? They're in demand.
Yeah.
So if they're good at their job and within reason, some people are just chancing it with money, like, and you're just like, come on, seriously, you're not going to get that. But this herein lies the problem. If we focus on the lowest price and not the maximum value, then are we focusing on the wrong things? Because don't we want to get these projects built
done
with everybody safe,
correct,
going home to their families? Don't we want these projects to be built with hiring the best staff to provide the best value? Because guess what? If someone's good at their job, they might cost you a little bit more. Their productivity is generally better because they get through things faster as well and at a higher quality, and they hold themselves to a higher standard.
Absolutely.
I think it's changing the narrative, exactly what you said. And instead of focusing on a race to the bottom, it's like, well, what's going to be the better outcome in terms of delivery, profit, safety, and a quality outcome? And until you change those conversations there, it makes it harder, at the other levels to be bidding these jobs.
No, absolutely. I think you're absolutely spot on, you know, and that's some of the conversations I've had with clients as well, where they say, oh, your fee. So obviously, as you know, in a price, I'll have my trade price and then I'll have my fee, which is, you know, my project manager, my site manager, my contract administrator, my safety person, etc. And they'll say, oh, you know, your fee looks a bit high. And I'll say to them, okay, well, you've got this project. It's going to go for 3 months. Do you think you need a project manager full-time on the job? And they go, yeah. And I go, okay, well, if I drop my fee, you can get a 60% project manager. So that project manager will be on your job 3 days a week, and 2 days a week I'll put him on something else. And they go, oh, no. I need someone that can call any day and that's full-time. And I go, well, that's the price. You know, you want me to do less, you're going to get less. If I drop my price, I need to cover the rest of that salary with another job. So you'll have someone who is 60% on your job and 40% on another job. I believe that's madness for the job that you've got and the attention that it deserves, but that's what you're asking me to do. You're asking me to put someone that's not going to give you their full attention. Would you like that? You know? And then they go, oh, well, someone else. Yeah. I'm like, well, good luck to them, you know, because my project manager also costs this much because she's the best I have. And I think
your
project deserves the best. So everything, like we said, you know, yeah, I can drop the price, but you don't get the same value. You know, it's a mathematical equation.
Someone said to me the other day, if you're focusing on value, don't discount your price without taking something away.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're giving a premium service and you believe in that and you believe that has to be done that way, stick to it. Stick to your gun. And if somebody's going to do it cheaper and they're going to do a half-baked service and that's what and they want to be in the race to the bottom, then let that happen.
Exactly. Yeah.
So your hike.
Yeah.
You went on a hike
I
with
did.
Your family.
Yeah.
We need to talk about this.
Cool.
I saw it on LinkedIn. Yeah. I was like, my husband has mentioned hikes. I was like, I think I need to hike first before taking our 5-year-old and 9-year-old. Tell me about, where did that goal come from you and what was that like with your family?
Yeah, look, I mean, it definitely came from, we had a very busy year. I work really long hours. Everyone's got so many activities and they're all at dance and netball and things. And I feel like,
hobbies.
And they're all on their phones. I mean, these dreaded things. I'm a culprit as well. I mean, I'm on my phone endlessly. And I thought, okay, why don't we challenge ourselves a little bit? It was very important for me to feel like the kids were being challenged as well as us, as well as myself. I feel like a lot of people have got sort of that growth and confidence backwards, you know, where they feel like they shouldn't attempt something until they feel confident to do it. But to me, it's like, let's just do it and then you'll feel confident after. And that was very true because a lot of them were like, I can't walk 65 kilometers with a 15 kilo backpack. I can't do it. And I was like, well, why don't we just try? Why don't we just try and see if we can or can't?
Let's have a go.
And then we just had to go and then they realized they could do it and suddenly they have more confidence about themselves opposed to, I'll wait until I feel ready or, you know, and that's life. That's what we do in life. You know, I'll wait until I feel ready to have kids. I'll wait until I feel ready to start my own business. I mean, I never felt ready to start Urban Core. I mean, if I waited to feel ready, man, I still wouldn't have started, right? So there was a bit of that mindset as well. And to me, definitely disconnecting from the phone was a really big drive. I just thought, because I'd read we'd have no reception and I was so happy about that. So, and it was incredible, the sort of the conversations that we struck up and, you know, we played card games and forever. And I really enjoyed the physical and mental challenge that it was. And then we tried to challenge ourselves a little bit more because we had all these huts along the way where we could sleep. And I was like, let's just, for added fun, let's just sleep outside and not in the hut and stuff. And the kids didn't want to do it. But then when they did it, they were so happy. And I think it was a really important lesson in planning as well, because we did have to take all the food with us. So we had, you know, 4 days, 5 people. So that's 3 meals a day. So it was 60 meals we had to plan. And the bags were so heavy. And I mean, my husband was actually even worse than the kids. He was like, let's drink all the water today. And I was like, yeah, well, that's a good idea. So I was just trying to, you know, keep everyone in line. So I was just being a project manager during the trip. But look, I think you have to do those things, Lauren. You have to make the time for them. It was actually a really bad time as well because I had a really big legal thing going on at the same time. And I was worried that it was going to be served documents or something during the hike. And I was like, and I told my lawyer, I said, look, I've got this hike that I've planned forever. And he was like, whatever you get can wait for you to finish your hike. Just don't even think about it. And it was really good that I couldn't think about it because I couldn't see if anything had happened. And I feel there's never a good time to switch off completely. You've just got to, it's kind of an effort, you know, you've got to decide mentally, okay, I'm not going to be connected to the outside world for 4 days. And it was amazing. So, yeah, I really am glad you're asking about that because I feel like, you know, we gained a lot out of it as a family. But the kids, you know, in their confidence, even though they lost their snap streaks and I'm the worst mother on the planet. Well, it was kind of cute because they were like, I hate this and how dare you and don't do this to us ever again. And I was the only one who had my phone to take photos. It was disconnected anyway, but I took theirs, so they weren't even tempted. Everything died anyway after 24 hours. And at the end, they were like, oh, can we have the photos? Can we have the photos? So I know they wanted to actually share with their friends what they'd done. So, you know, it was they did like it. And then they did ask, oh, what's the next one? So I was happy with that.
It's a good lesson. And I do love what you said, that I think people feel whether you're starting your own business, going on a crazy hike or doing something really, you know, that could be risky, that you suddenly go, oh, I'm ready to start a business and I'm not worried at all, or I feel like I can do 60Ks, and that you don't have that fear factor or that those really human fears. Yeah. It's just not true. It's just not true.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like a lot of people ask me, you know, why did you start Urban Core? And to me, it is a lot about what I didn't know. I feel like if I had known what it actually meant to start a construction company, probably wouldn't have done it, you know? So there's a bit of sometimes, well, just don't try and, well, look, you know, I was consciously going into it, but it was, I'm not doing this because it's easy, but am I doing it because I thought it was going to be easier than it is? Yes, absolutely. So, but, and of course I don't regret it either. You know, I think it was a really good, of course I don't regret it. I'm happy with what I'm doing. But at the time it did really feel like jumping off a cliff and let's build the aeroplane on the way down, you know, see if we land somewhere. So,
yeah. And when you go down a pathway and it's hard and you've got staff and family relying on you, the reality is it's like those quiet moments where you have a good cry or a good outlet. I think that we glorify a lot of the time entrepreneurship or going out and starting a business when it's just freaking hard.
Yeah.
That's the reality. You know tax and BAS and all that sort of stuff, but you're not really aware of the complexity of your obligations. We've got constantly changing legislations and psychosocial safety and new things coming out that you're kind of adapting to all the time.
Yeah.
So there's that certain level of fatigue from keeping up to speed. Yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely. And also I think what I underestimated probably, and it's true more now that I've got a bigger company, is almost everything is people now. Everyone's always working harder than everybody else and everyone's always hard done by, and, you know, you're like, no, you're not.
Yep.
You really are not working harder than everybody else. I know it feels that way. I've been there. But so I'm learning as well. I think, you know, become an HR person as well. As
Well, the other thing, we've got this thing like obviously people want to bring their whole selves to work, but that also totally get that need of the belonging and things like that. But I think what we don't talk about in leadership is how exhausting it can be to manage a whole bunch of people's emotions.
Yes.
Like, let's be honest, that's hard.
It's super hard. And, you know, I've had people like come to me and say, oh, I'm being bullied and harassed, you know, the big words. And I'm like, sounds like you're just being asked to do your job. I don't know. That's just an email saying, where is this? Because it was due the day before. That's not bullying. And in fact, you know, I encourage actually people, because actually a slightly different topic here, Lauren, but to me, I want women to speak up, right? Women or men, I want everyone to speak up for themselves and say, if someone calls you something and you don't like it, just say, hey, that's not on. Don't call me that. Or don't talk to me like this. Hey, whatever. But we have kind of, we've become a bit of a nanny state, you know, where we've set up this, oh, call the Fair Work and have put in a complaint and go behind the scenes and try and do this. And it's like, just resolve an issue right here, right now. You know, why are we making this so complicated? And even, you know, some of my, you know, ex-employees who've made complaints to me and said, oh, such and such said that. And I'm like, do they know that that's a problem for you? Because I can talk to them, but really you just need to say it. And, you know, you've got young kids and the whole stop it, I don't like it.
Yes.
That's for adults as well. That's all it takes. You know, you don't like being spoken to in a certain way, or the way an email was worded, or it sounded a bit harsh, or speak up, you know, and have that chat right now. Like, one of the things I actually really love about construction is that generally people are quite raw with their feelings, which is why we have the bad reputation.
Mm.
But it's also, you know where you You have on site a really big screaming match, and then it ends and everyone's hugging each other, having a beer together. And you see other industries that are probably more sophisticated, like law and banking, and it's maybe 6 months of being bypassed or shadowed or intimidated, and it's all like really kind of insidious and backstabbing. And that's mentally really destroying compared to someone calling you, catcalling you on a site. You know, you can get over that in 10 seconds. Just say, dude, stop, don't do that, not here, you know, whatever. It's, and then they don't do it again. We're giving this image that it's so rough and difficult, but in fact, I think on a psychological level, it's actually easier to deal with than some, what I hear of abuse, like psychological abuse in other industries that are way more sophisticated. So,
I think of this and I think of construction as well, and what you said about schools and things like that. Another thing, it starts in schools right around when we look around the kind of culture we want to create in workplaces as well. When my daughter says, or my son said, they're being bullied, I said, what have you done to deal with the situation? I'm not coming in to talk to the teacher.
That's right.
I'm not coming in. If I'm doing that for you, I'm not teaching you resilience. I'm not teaching you to deal with the situation. And we want to be careful that we're not creating that in the workplace. We need to be encouraging those open conversations. I agree. Yeah. Construction is like that. You can be so annoyed at someone and not agree with them on something and have a heated discussion, and then the next day you're having a coffee, beer or whatever together and it's fine because that was the issue that you're dealing with. It's not a personal attack. What's the legacy you want to leave for the work that you've been doing in this space?
I'd love to see, and I don't know legacy, how far away that is, but to me, the legacy I want to leave as Urban Core is that you can have a diverse workforce, a female-led construction company, you know, which forever and until now has always looked like the underdog and the ones that are probably not going to succeed and become this successful company and become this case study that it actually works. I feel like, you know, if I can be like this little, you know, there was once this experiment and this woman started a construction company and she had 50% women and they turned over $200 million a year and they were successful and they're still around 50 years later, that's the legacy. That's kind of like saying, leading by example and hoping that people will follow through and say, oh, actually it works and actually can be done. And so that's kind of, you know, what I'm hoping is the start of a change. And also what I'm hoping is that clients and principals, they'll come to me for what I do, which will then inspire people to do what I do so that the industry changes as a whole and we have this snowball effect.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Dom. I really appreciated your insights. And
pleasure.
I'm keen to see if people want to learn more about you, support you, where can they find you, follow you, or get involved?
Definitely LinkedIn is the best platform for me. So, yeah, you can find me at Dominique Gill.
And we'll share links to NextGen,
yes,
share links to your website and everything in the show notes as well for people that are interested.
That would be fantastic.
Thanks for coming on as a guest, Dom. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Building Doors. If you've got comments or questions, send them to hello@buildingdoors.com.au. And remember to subscribe, rate, and review. See you next time.